This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott, and if we got a great show for you tonight, no, we don't. Damn it. The phone is ringing again. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, east of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You're at work, but hoping to get off because landscapers are coming soon to trim the bush in the front and you'd like to watch? But you have to slip out the back door and ride the train home if they'll let you on board with your giant package? Breather, do you know how that sounds? What is wrong with you? What do you mean it sounds like we're about to do another lame podcast loaded with double entendres and bad puns? Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on? Winona's Big Brown Beaver by Primus? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be Winona's Big Brown Beaver by bass-heavy alt-rockers Primus. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
A sonic masterpiece, a visual spectacle, experience of a lifetime. Rush, Clockwork Angels Tour. Lifeson, Neil Peart. North American tour starts April 23rd. A concert unlike anything ever seen before. Tickets on sale beginning January 28th. An evening with Rush. The time is now.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter, Rico Cronkite, on the line. Rico, how are you tonight, sir?
Fantastico. And yourself?
Not too shabby. I'm in the mood for some rock and roll news. What's going on out there?
Before we do that, I want to just quickly go, because you, for anybody who might not know, I'm a big Rush fan. They're my go-to favorite band for a very long time. And over the weekend, I went down a rabbit hole, and I told you about this rabbit hole that I went down. So about 3 days ago, I had Big Money off the Power Windows album stuck in my head for some reason. And I really can't explain that. So I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to listen to Power Windows. I'm going to fucking go for it. Right. So what I wound up doing over the entirety of the weekend, I listened to every single post Moving Pictures Rush album in order from like the whole rest of the catalog after Moving Pictures, and I finished it up with Clockwork Angels yesterday, actually. So I did, over the weekend, I did every single album after Moving Pictures in order. It wasn't something I planned on doing. It just kind of happened. Some quick thoughts. I don't want this to turn into a whole episode, but there's a reason why I'm bringing this up. So first of all, Everybody bangs on Hold Your Fire. They think it's the worst one. I highly disagree. It really is a good album. It's not as bad as everybody says it is. People bang on Roll the Bones. They don't like that the rap part is in there. It's not that bad. It's well written. It's kind of cheesy, but that's okay. A little they're having fun. Let them have some fun. Neil Peart is really overly serious, in my opinion, sometimes. And he had a little bit of fun with that song. Let them have it. Here's the thing that I wanted to bring up. You often talk about how much you like Counterparts, which was in what, the early 90s, right? You talk about how much you like that album. And when I listened to that album, it had been a long time, and I've always kind of dismissed Counterparts for some reason. Don't really ask me why. I can't really explain it to you. But this time around, wow, did I really enjoy that album. I really enjoyed Counterparts, man. I really underestimated how good this album is. It's fantastic. I can't believe, like, you are absolutely right on Counterparts. It's a great album. I mean, I can't believe I don't go back to that one. Yeah, pat yourself on the back. Couple of other quick thoughts. Test for Echo and Snakes and Arrows are my two least favorite albums. They're so vanilla and boring, and I don't like either one of them. And the funny thing that I texted you about today, my final thought, and then if you want have some thoughts, I would like to hear them. Their heaviest album is the last one, Clockwork Angels, the concept album. The last album they ever did is, in my opinion, the heaviest album in their entire catalog. Which is, I think that's kind of ironic that the very last one, and frankly, I think Clockwork Angels is a superb album. It's fantastic. And I have one more quick thought about that, but I want to see if you have any quick thoughts on that.
I think Vapor Trails is pretty damn heavy too.
It is. Agree.
You know what? When Clockwork Angels came out, Rico, I do all Rush albums when they came out, when they were an active band, is I would always see what they were up to. You know, there was always curiosity about creatively kind of where they were at. So I would always, you know, connect with those records and spin them. But I didn't never gave Clockwork Angels. I gave it a few listens, but I never gave it the time that a Rush album, or really any record, in my opinion, requires to kind of like set and gel with the listener. So I gave it a few spins, but I didn't really spend a lot of time with the record. Obviously very familiar with the single. What was that? Headlong Flight, I think it was called. But so I can't offer like a, you know, what I would consider a valid criticism or opinion of that record, only because I listened to it like, you know, a handful of times.
I will agree with you on Vapor Trails. It's really is a really heavy, really good album. There's no, if I'm not mistaken, there's no keyboard in Vapor Trails at all, which I think is pretty cool. And I have a question. I'm not necessarily for you, because you haven't really put too much time into Clockwork Angels, but I want to ask the listeners out there to help me out with something. I feel like, and then we can move on, I feel like Clockwork Angels, and maybe this is Captain Obvious stuff, but I've always thought this, and I've thought this about a lot of Neil Peart's lyrics, but I feel like Clockwork Angels is his swan song, his self-reflective, autobiographical reflection on his career in a one last final shoot my wad kind of a thing. Does that make sense? And I want to ask the listeners out there if they think the same thing, that this is an autobiographical compilation reflection of his career. And I want to know if anybody else out there thinks the same thing. So, having said that, let's move on. Email us or, you know, message us on Twitter, but I want to hear if anybody has an opinion on that. This one's gonna be quick. I don't even know why this fucking matters, but I feel like I need to mention this. So Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth are, I don't even know why I'm mentioning this, but I have to. Sammy Hagar is slamming David Lee Roth. And this just, dude, this just came out, man, on Metal Sucks. I don't know why this is a story, but apparently it's a story. So I guess, you know, they toured together with Van Halen back in, what, 2007 or something like that. But here's kind of some of the things that that Sammy Hagar is saying about David Lee Roth. And then I want to get your reaction to this. He's not a fun guy. He doesn't play. This is Sammy Hagar talking about David Lee Roth. He's not a fun guy. He doesn't play well with others. I'm not sure what his problem is. He's just always been about how can I make this guy look bad? He says he's a chest beating motherfucker. He says he's a showman. He doesn't give a shit about his voice. His voice is terrible because he doesn't take care of it. He says it drives him crazy that his voice is so bad and he doesn't give a shit about it. And Sammy Hagar says he cares more about his voice than he cares about his own dick. So I don't know why this is a story, but I want to get your thoughts on this. So Sammy Hagar slamming David Lee Roth on April 20 in a story posted April 24th. Tell me why this matters.
I don't. Sammy's funny, man, because every time he does an interview, it's like before Eddie passed, it was always, you know, he would always be kind of talking about, oh man, Van Halen, you know. It's like I think a part of him was upset that Van Halen had kind of abandoned his portion of the catalog, and I don't blame him. Those are hit records. And you know, so I think he was trying to like keep it alive, right? By always mentioning it and always kind of championing like a reunion, or, you know, always kind of trying to extend that olive branch. And if he couldn't extend an olive branch, then he'd just kick sand and try to just, you know, rustle up some controversy. But he's always seemed to like play the media to, I don't know, just to keep it out there, keep some level of interest buzzing. I don't know. I mean, Roth is for all intents and purposes in retirement. So I don't know what benefit Sammy Hagar gets out of, you know, dragging Roth through the mud. And it's nothing that he hasn't said before. This isn't anything new. He said all these things in the past and other venues and other opportunities. So I don't know. Is he wrong about this stuff? No. I mean, Roth's voice sucks. He's never been good live ever, even when he was young. You know, and that's, you know, he's a difficult guy. He comes off as the party guy, but I've read several Van Halen books, the Greg Renoff books. I've read the Noel Monk book. I've read the Brad Tolinitsky's book. So I've read like three Van Halen books, and, you know, not that that gives me supreme knowledge, but the one thing that you glean from reading those that's consistent is that Roth is a cranky guy. You know, he's like depressive at times, you know, where he's sometimes he's over the moon, happy and excited. And other times he, you know, he's really dark. And so that's, you know, Sammy just strikes me as a guy who's just, you know, he is as you see him. He is Hawaiian shirt, drink in hand, big smile on his face. And that's Sammy Hagar all the time. So someone like Roth, who's a little cantankerous and moody and has these and vacillates between, you know, upbeat, happy, wild party guy to down in the dumps, likes to fight guy. I can see where someone like Sammy Hagar, who's a pretty positive person, you know, that kind of personality, he wouldn't be able to make sense of it. But ironically, I mean, Eddie Van Halen had the same kind of personality. I mean, I think that's why he and Roth had so much friction, is because they were so much alike in that regard, and that they were both moody motherfuckers. So I don't know, man. It's just, Rico, I don't have anything to offer other than just why now, you know, what benefit Sammy, I don't think Sammy's promoting anything right now. So to what benefit is it for him to take the opportunity to bash David Lee Roth? I don't know.
Well, and that was my question. I mean, okay, let's do this chest thumping like 15 years ago or 20 years ago when Van Halen is touring with David Lee, with a really shitty sounding David Lee Roth. But now that's why I wanted to ask you about it, because now it just doesn't make any fucking sense to me. But so when you talk about David Lee Roth's moodiness and Eddie Van Halen's moody. Do you think these dudes were like maybe a little bipolar, or do you think it was because of all the blow that they did for so many years? Or maybe a little bit of both, because if they're both moody like that, you know, maybe it's because of all the blow they did.
I mean, dude, you're joking, I assume, but
no, I'm not actually.
In rock music, serious. I mean, the blow was legendary, dude. I mean, and all these bands were doing so much coke back in the day. So sure, some of it is drug related. I mean, you're not going to be in a great mood all the time if you've been up for three fucking days, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, so I think there is some of that, but also I think they're just complex dudes. I mean, I think they're not, I mean, that's people, right? I mean, we all know people who are, I'm a moody guy, you know, I don't do drugs, but it's like, you know, I think we all know people are different. Some people are just up, you know. Michael Anthony, for everything I've ever read about Michael Anthony, is the most likable, even keeled dude. He's like the perfect guy you'd want in your band, because he's going to show up on time. He's going to give you 100% effort. He's not going to rock the boat. He's going to be an all-in team player. And what did he get for that out of Van Halen? He got shit on. You know what I mean? They treated him like shit.
He got an hourly paycheck.
They gave him writing credits, you know, full quarter writing credits all the way up till 1984 when they cut him out completely. But it's like, with no explanation, but honestly, they were generous in giving him any writing credits anyways. But people are people, right? I mean, Sammy is just a perpetually upbeat guy. He is the who's the fucking Margaritaville guy? Jimmy Buffett. He's the Jimmy Buffett of hard rock. He is that character. And David Lee Roth is, I mean, he is like, we know the image that David Lee Roth had from the 80s, you know, of Dave TV and California Girls and Just a Gigolo and all that. And that's Roth. That is. But there's also a dark side of Roth. Like, if you read Noel Monk, used to be the Van Halen's manager back in the 70s. He managed Van Halen from Van Halen 1 all the way to 1984. So he managed the prime era of Van Halen. His book is fascinating. If anyone has never read this book, it is an amazing book. It dishes the dirt. Noel passed away like a year ago. And David Lee Roth would be a grumpy and mean motherfucker. And like, so all this, like all of the kind of flamboyant, over the top Vegas Dave that you see in his persona, that Dave could be like a really, really cold dude. And I think, and I mean, the famous story is like the 96 MTV Almost reunion, whenever they go out at the MTV Music Awards and David Lee Roth comes out with Eddie, Alex, and Michael, and it's kind of leads the audience to believe that there's going to be a reunion, right? And this is 96, and so people are kind of excited, and I think Dave thought there was going to be a reunion, but Eddie wanted nothing to do with playing with Dave again. And the funny thing is, this shows like the mean side of Dave. It's a great little story, but Eddie starts talking to the press about, at the time, he needed hip surgery. So Eddie's talking to the press about his hip, and this is after the big night, whenever Dave comes out with Van Halen, and it's like Dave's dream come true. He's like, I'm back in the band, you know, I'm back on top. And Dave rips into Eddie Van Halen, and he's like, what the fuck are you talking to the press on my big night about your goddamn hip for? And his point was, you clueless motherfucker, this is rock and roll, and nothing makes you look more out of touch and old than having a bad hip if you're a rock star, you know? And so, you know, that sort of thing is Eddie just thinking about music, right? Eddie's just a musician. He doesn't think about showbiz. He thinks about music. Dave thinks about showbiz. And to Dave, if you're supposed to be a rock star, the last fucking thing you do is talk about needing hip surgery. There's nothing less rock and roll than hip surgery. So nothing makes you sound like more of a dinosaur, right? And so Dave and Eddie famously got into a big fight backstage at the MTV thing, all over fucking Eddie's hip. So, you know, Dave can be a mean guy.
Although I will say that in contrast to all of that, I will say that some of his like low-key acoustic like reflective blues stuff that he puts out every once in a while, I kind of really dig that stuff, and I wish he would do more of it, actually.
Yeah, I think there's a whole record of it sitting out there with John 5 that he hasn't released. But I love Dave's solo stuff. I love him with Van Halen. I love his solo stuff, and I don't mind that his voice isn't great. It's like, but you know, it's that's an old conversation. But why in the hell is Sammy Hagar picking on David Lee Roth right now? Who knows?
I mean, the timing is kind of bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah,
I don't get it.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough about that. Listen, have you ever, and the answer for me would be absolutely no, but I saw this story and it's kind of fascinates me for some reason. Have you ever heard of the band called Bellwitch? You ever heard of them?
No, sir.
They are a two-man doom metal band out of Seattle, Washington. It's a bass player and a drummer, and the drummer slash vocalist is actually their second drummer slash vocalist. The first one died just a few years ago, and there's a story out. They just have a surprise release called, let me get this right, Futures. The album is Futures Shadow Part One, and the song, there's only one song on the album, and it's called The Clandestine Gate. The song, and this song is 83 minutes long. This is not their first 83 minute long song, by the way. Their first 83 minute song is called Mirror Reaper, and it's kind of was put together. He was inspired by the death of the first bandmate, and so he kind of put Mirror Reaper together. But the difference between, and I listened to Mirror Reaper, the difference between Mirror Reaper and the clandestine gate is part one of a three-part thing that they're putting out. So this is an 83 minute long part one. I'm fascinated by this. I listened to both of these songs today. Actually, I listened to like 3 hours of Bellwitch today, and it was, let me tell you, I didn't like what the hell's the first one called? Mirror Reaper. I didn't like Mirror Reaper as much as I liked The Clandestine Gate, and here's why. In The Clandestine Gate, a lot of the vocals was that really guttural growl, kind of a Phil Anselmo, like 37 generations down the line. I couldn't understand. I read the lyrics, but I couldn't understand what he was saying. Didn't matter though, because the reason why this song is so fucking good is because what Mirror Reaper didn't have that The Clandestine Gate does have is this really cool 80s horror synthesizers and like funeral organ that they have going throughout the song, and it's really super artful, and I really liked it. Actually, I can't wait till part two comes out. I can't wait for a doom metal song to come out. I never listened to doom metal before, and you kind of razzed me about needing a framework and everything, but I went into this one cold turkey without a framework. I'm like, fuck it, I'm gonna let her rip, man. I need anybody out there who's listened to this to give me their feedback on this, because I really liked this song. I encourage everybody to check it out. The synth is what really throws it over the top, in my opinion.
And how long is the song?
It's 83 minutes. It's 1 hour and 23 minutes. So for Clandestine Gate, it kind of goes like this, and this is the way I see it. There's kind of like a 20 or 25 minute kind of ramp up, like the intro to get ready for the meat and potatoes is about 20 or 25 minutes long. Then you've got like 40 minutes of meat and potatoes in the middle. And then you've got another like 23 minutes where they kind of wane it down, and they kind of slowly end it over the last 23 minutes. So it kind of goes like that. It kind of ramps up for 20 or so minutes. It kind of hits you in the boo-boo for about 40 minutes, and then it ramps down for about 23 minutes. It's fascinating. Really great, really artful song. I really wish everybody would listen to it.
Well, I don't know anything about 80 minutes of Bell Witch, but I do know about 80 minutes of Ball Itch. And I have that frequently, where you're just scratching and scratching and scratching and unable to get any relief because things are so, you get so much swamp ass and dirty, scratchy taint that you're just uncomfortable. You ever take like a sharp object, like a flathead screwdriver or butter knife, and just kind of rake it down there just to kind of satisfy some of the discomfort?
No, but what is your, that's a good tip though. I'll keep that in mind. My preferred method is like the pinch and roll technique on my ball sack.
I remember the pinch and roll technique. Yeah.
Pinch and roll technique is very effective still, actually.
Yeah, it gives you stinky finger though.
Well, if you go on top of your pants. Now, see, that was my question. Let's say you're at work and you have a ball itch like there's no tomorrow and there's people around. Do you eat it and just suffer through the torture like you're in the movie Hellraiser and you just keep on getting that torture and then eventually you love it? Or do you just say fuck it and try and sneak it down there and give yourself an itch and hope that nobody notices?
Yeah, I usually just start shifting violently in my seat. We got to wrap the news, man.
Does that work when you shift violently in your seat?
I mean, you can usually generate some friction down there if you have to get things, if things are itchy.
All right, listen. So having said that, I need a break so I can go scratch my balls. When we come back, we're going to talk about, in my opinion, a ridiculously underrated and misunderstood band. We're going to be talking some Primus. So hang out. We'll be right back.
America, demand your MTV. I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
MTV, music, television, video, music, 24 hours a day. And it's stereo.
Hello, baby.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted under the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm. A sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. So this is, that's right, Winona's Big Brown Beaver, off of the album Tales from the Punch Bowl, released in 1995. It's about 4 minutes and 23 seconds. Les Claypool and the gang wrote it and produced it. I'm a big fan of Primus. Saw them live when they opened up for Rush Rush kind of took them under their wing, and just like Kiss took Rush under their wing, and they toured with them for a while. And I really like this band. I can't wait to talk about them.
Nice beaver.
Thank you, Rico. All right, gang, it's Rock and Roll Autopsy. We got to find out if Winona's big brown beaver killed Rock and Roll. Now, there's a sentence I never thought I'd hear myself saying, but here we are.
Nice beaver.
And to do so, of course, Rico, we've got our own proprietary scientific method. There are five categories that have worked now for 71 episodes to determine who the culprits are, the guilty parties who killed Rock and Roll. Category one is gratuitous boomerism. Category two, excessive misogyny. Category three, wanton whiteness. Category four, malignant machismo. And category five, culture vulturism. Rico, the song is Winona's Big Brown Beaver, the band. Les Claypool and the boys, Primus. Some serious bass guitar here, my friend. Gratuitous boomerism, category one. What say you?
I know you've got this memorized. So we're trying to first establish if he gets the obligatory 0.5. I believe not. He was born in 63. Scott is 60. Where does 63 land him? I know you got this shit memorized.
I think he's a boomer. Let's see. So 46 to 64 is the boomers.
Boomers. So technically he's a boomer. Man, I hate to give him the obligatory 0.5 on this because he's far from being a boomer. He doesn't have any of the mentality of a boomer. He's way too out of the box for that. But unfortunately, the science is the science. I don't want to do it. I'm obligated to do it. I have to do the 0.5, even though I highly disagree. There's nothing about this song that has that unrelatable kind of boomerishness to it, in my opinion. So I have to stick true to the science and I'm forced to do the 0.5 for the obligatory boomerism based on his year of birth.
Yeah. I will have to give it a 0.5 as well because science. The other two guys are not, however, the drummer is like right there, and then Larry, the guitar player, is a little younger. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to stick with the 0.5, although I think you could make an argument for, and I know when we think of boomer, we think of, you know, Bob Dylan or something, right? But
yeah,
you know, I do think you can make an argument, Rico, that the lyrics, not how eccentric the band is. Did I say that word right?
Eccentric.
You know, they're an odd outside the box kind of band, right? They don't paint inside the lines. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. In spite of that though, the lyrics, I could certainly see these lyrics, even though they do leave it open to interpretation. You don't even have to go any further than the song title. I could see it being problematic in 2023.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that for sure. I mean, Les Claypool has, I did see where he admitted, how could he not? He did recognize the double entendre in the song. Obviously it's there. We'll get to the origin of the song maybe when in a category or two, but I can see your point on that. But it's not enough for me to round it up to a full one.
I'm right there with you. I'm going to give it a 0.5 as well. Rico, let's move on. Category two, excessive misogyny. And I've got lyrics available if you need to hear them, sir.
Hit me.
Winona's got herself a big brown beaver and she shows it off to all her friends. One day, you know, that beaver tried to leave her, so she caged him up with cyclone fence. Along came Lou with the old baboon and said, "Recognize that smell? Smells like seven layers. That beaver eats Taco Bell." Do you need another verse, Rico?
No, I'm good. But what's funny is, I was looking at, I was on song meanings and people's, let me read, because this is typically what you do, but I would like to have a stab at this tonight.
Love it.
some of these people's theories about this song. really kind of funny. I'd be all over a beaver that smells like Taco Bell if it's the beavers that smell like Burger King that I have a problem with. The meaning of this song, and this is by Jesus, I guess that's how you say that. The meaning of this song is that Winona was a whore that ended up with an STD. Notice after the first guy, all the other men were attacked by the beaver, but the beaver was quick and it grabbed him by the kiwis and he ain't pissed for a week. Why do you think he hasn't pissed for a week and a half? Because it burns. The line, she picked her finger one that pricked her, pricked her finger one day and it occurred to her she might have a porcupine, to me is just an analogy for her finding out she had an STD.
I mean, I can buy it.
I mean, for sure. Here's another one. One more quick one. This song is very obviously about a tranny prostitute. One of the easiest songs to interpret by Primus, the beaver is his vagina, and Rex is a customer who either gets a disease from realizes the prostitute has a penis and is traumatized. Only part I've debated over, but I think it's the disease. The only reason I know it's about a tranny is the last line. She pricked her finger and one day it occurred to her she might have a porcupine. That line completely invalidates the theory that the song is actually about a girl and her pet beaver, unless the girl is blind. So there you have it. There's just a couple of theories about the meaning of this song.
And when did that person post that? Because I think tranny is now officially a derogatory slur for that. It. So that must be an old post.
2011, actually. So that post is 12 years old.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, gratuitous boomerism on that post.
Yeah. My goodness. Sure. Holy mackerel. But in reality, the song was inspired. Are you ready? By a real beaver. Les Claypool was fly fishing with a friend of his in California, and they were walking back to the car and they kind of got separated and kind of just were doing their own thing for a minute. And Les was walking down a trail by himself and he looked up and there was a fucking beaver staring him right in the face and scared the shit out of him. And he said he thinks he scared the shit out of the beaver too. And it really stuck with him. So he wrote a song about it. And this is the song that he wrote. So this is a song inspired, ladies and gentlemen, by a real encounter with a real beaver.
So where are you at? Excessive misogyny.
This is an absolute zero for sure.
Yeah, it's, and to the point of, I thank you for reading those pieces from Song Meanings. What's the website? Songmeanings.com.
Songmeanings.com. Correct.
Yeah, we've used it a number of times. It's a fun resource. But yeah, I mean, there is a double entendre. It's called humor. And you know, there is a double entendre here at work, and that's what makes it fun, right? Because it's kind of taboo, right? And it has this, and the funny thing was inspired by an actual beaver, but it has this wordplay going on, and Les clearly is having fun with the lyrics throughout. And so it leads people to have multiple interpretations of it. So having said that, what is my score? Well, I think I'm going to go ahead and I'm not going to give it a full one. I think I'm going to be generous, actually, because I got to have my 2023 glasses on. And so I'm just going to give it a 0.5 for basically using the beaver as a muse, whether it's regardless of whether it's got four legs or not, which is going down that road, I guess, even going there. I'm just going to give it a 0.5 for just going there. And so let's move on.
I mean, by referring to a woman's private area as a beaver, does that automatically garner a 0.5 in this category?
Thank you. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes.
Okay. I could go there with you, but I'm going to stick to my zero because I'm not rolling back another point.
Category 3, wanton whiteness. Winona's big brown beaver, Primus. Rico, what say you?
Well, again, because science, I think we altered this category and decided that if they were white, then they would get an obligatory 0.5 for being white. However, I do that painfully, and I might even roll it back to a zero because of just how funky this motherfucker is. In fact,
country funk,
I reserve the right, because I am 50% of this podcast, to roll back my obligatory 0.5 to a zero. So I'm, because he's a funky motherfucker and he slaps bass like a bastard, I'm rolling this bitch back to a zero, and I'm removing that 0.5.
Love it. But is this one of their funkier songs? I mean, I guess, you know, it's got a little country twang to it, doesn't it?
Certainly does.
That was a weird burp.
Like, it would be funk tree, right?
Yeah, funk tree.
Funk and funk tree.
Yeah, I mean, Les Claypool is a funky guy, but I think you also just, I mean, he's a fisherman. He's a little bit of a hillbilly.
He really is.
And he's a, it's funny too, because this band like got started like around 84, and like they came up in that same area and that same scene with like all the thrash bands in California, Metallica and all those thrash bands. And they kind of like ran in the same circles even. So it's just kind of funny, but you don't think of California being this way, but they kind of have areas of California that are a lot like here in Ohio, where you just have straight up rednecks. And I think Les Claypool does skew a little bit that direction. He's a little bit of a hillbilly. So I guess I guess it's a polite way of saying I'm just going to stick with the point. You know what? I'm going to go the other direction. I'm going to give it a full one.
All right.
Guy's writing about beavers. He's a fisherman. He's a little bit of a hillbilly. I see him in the Long Johns and the Jerry Was a Race Car Driver video. I'm going full one on this for Les Claypool more than anything. And yeah, even the subject matter of the song, and full one, wanton white.
I love Jerry Was a Race Car Driver, but I think my favorite part is the very beginning where you hear him saying in the background where they're trying to start the car. And he goes, "Oh man, fired up!" And yeah, then they start the song.
yeah, exactly.
Did you see? Speaking of growing up and or working there, did you see the story about where he tried out for Metallica? After the accident.
Yeah, and they were like, "You're too good."
Yeah, you're too good.
Yeah. That
was fun. So yeah, okay. So you're going full one. I'm gonna stick with my zero because he's a funky bitch.
Love it. All right, let's go on. Category 4, malignant machismo. Interesting kind of, I'm curious what your take is on this. What do you think?
He's a goofy redneck, kind of a funk tree, funk slap bass guy, but we're talking about the song too.
Yes.
And so that's important to note here. So the song is kind of the double entendre kind of gives it a little bit of machismo, because of the, let's see, the way Winona and her pet beaver are portrayed is kind of under the thumb, so to speak. And so I think I might do a 0.5 on this one for malignant machismo. It's not full in your face. It's not Hetfield stance. It's not like any of those other forms of like in your face machismo, but it's got a little bit of tongue in cheek, double entendre sort of machismo that for me gets a 0.5, I think.
Kind of track back here for a minute. Yeah. Kirk Hammett of Metallica and Les Claypool actually went to school together.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Hammett, I'm reading this out of Wiki, gave Claypool a copy of Ride the Lightning, and Claypool wasn't really a metal guy, but appreciated what they were doing. And when he auditioned for the band, Claypool actually had no idea how big the band actually was, which is just kind of funny. But
yeah,
you could be that oblivious.
Yeah, totally.
Malignant Machismo. Listen, again, it's a double entendre. The lyrics are clever. They're funny. His lyrics are terrific in the catalog across the board. They're often funny. They often work on multiple levels. A lot of double entendres employed in the lyrics in the Primus catalog. Very clever writers, almost Zappa-like in the way they utilize humor and storytelling. And just how weird the music is. But I gotta, Rico, for Malignant Machismo, I feel like I'm gonna give this a one because I just... I'm not going to use the term beaver in the presence of women.
That's I can't argue with that, man.
I would be, even if there was, if my wife and I were at a picnic and there was a beaver approaching our picnic basket, I probably wouldn't say, honey, a beaver. I don't think I would even, I might call it a critter or a varmint. I'm just probably not going to even go there and engage in that terminology in the presence of a woman. So it feels like the subject matter is something. It's a term that only dudes use. Women don't use this term. So it's a subject So this is a very male song. You know, this is a song that dude would write. It's dude humor. It's using dude vernacular and a dude getting a kick out of the double entendre of the big brown beaver. And oh, by the way, the big brown beaver. And so I have to score this a full one.
So are we saying that we have to put the term beaver in the same category with like moist and goiter? So like some of those words that people just don't want to hear.
I mean, I just don't think that, I mean, I'm not a woman. So I can't. And if there are any women out there listening, if I'm speaking out of school, I'm happy to admit when I'm wrong. I really am. So I'm sure I've said a million things on this podcast that people could challenge me on. And I would probably have to listen back and think, yeah, that was dumb. But I'm just going to be audacious enough to attempt to speak for women, but I just don't think women want their private parts referred to as a beaver. So
can I ask you kind of a shady question? Yes. What do you think girls in general would have a bigger issue with, beaver or pussy? Cause I've heard girls say pussy in many different ways to refer to many different things. And I've also heard girls say that they don't like that term.
Yes.
So I've heard both actually.
Yeah. Rico, I've heard that there's certain words. I know see you next Tuesday is one they never want to hear. That's, you know,
I know plenty that I don't have a problem with it at all. Actually.
With see you next Tuesday.
Oh, for sure.
Really? Well,
for sure.
I've heard that is like the one that's like the most offensive.
Right. I mean, that's like the top of the food chain with regard to offensive female type words.
Right.
But I do know a lot of females who really they say that word and they don't have a problem. They use it actually. So yeah. What do you think's worse, beaver or pussy? Because they're kind of on the same level, right?
Didn't we just have a big hit song with WAP?
Oh yeah, that's right.
Like a year ago.
That's yeah, like
or
a year
two or 2 years ago, whatever it was.
Right. So apparently that word's not too bad.
But I guess I'm saying is that it just kind of came in a big way into the what a weird tangent we got off on. That word though became like a big thing in kind of the, I'm going to say it again, the cultural zeitgeist. I mean, there were people who that was a funny one because there were men that were offended that Cardi B was, and I think it's one of those like empowerment things where she's owning the word, right? So she's just saying wet ass pussy, right? And she's owning it. And men can be threatened by women who are that kind of who own their sexuality like that, right? And are and have that level. Like, was it? God, I hope I'm not wrong. Was it Geezer Butler from Black Sabbath who got all upset about it? It might be. And if I'm wrong,
isn't that funny? Bad. Isn't that funny though? How things turned around like that. And it's like there. She took on and I don't know if maybe I'm going there or not, but she took ownership as a female of the word pussy, like Black people take ownership of the N-word,
right?
Like, I can say this and now you can't, right?
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's one of those things where it's funny how that even became, I don't know, it's just funny. Sometimes in the culture, things kind of bubble to the surface and become popular and you're like, really? Are we, is this a thing? You know, Wet Ass Pussy is like the biggest song in the country right now.
And it's funny because guys that I work with, I remember guys that I work with have a problem with that song. So it's super ironic how things flipped on its ear with that song.
Yeah.
It's so interesting, man. And funny. God,
that
it's
men weird. Get uncomfortable with it. Men who have penned like hundreds of rock songs and rap songs about their dicks.
Right.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's okay for a dude to like a song about another dude railing a teenager, but this girl can't refer to her own vagina as a wet ass pussy, right?
I mean, David Coverdale literally named a band after his penis, Whitesnake. I mean, literally.
Or every AC/DC song.
Yep. But I mean, David, there's no more, in my opinion, Whitesnake. I mean, David Coverdale literally named the band named the band after his penis, and then did records called Slide It In. You know, I mean, there's
but that's no but that's okay because we have a half naked Tawny Kitaen dancing on a car, so which makes it all okay, right? But if Cardi B says wet ass pussy, then all of a sudden these same dudes, these very same guys, have a big problem with that. Just right. Funny.
That's funny. All right, so let's move. So I give it a 1, and you gave it a 0, right?
A
0.5. Sorry. Yeah, 0.5. All right, let's move on and wrap up this rock and roll autopsy before we get ourselves into any more trouble. Category 5, the final category, culture vulturism for Wynonna's Big Brown Beaver. Les Claypool and the boys. Rico, how do you score it?
I mean, this song is a little twangy. It's a little bit slappy, but holy Christ, I don't see. And if you can score this above a 0, I'm really interested to hear what you have to say. But they are so unique and so out of the box. And over the years, I've probably listened to most, if not all, of their albums from one point in time to another. There is nothing. Culture, their sound is so unique. They're kind of like the uniqueness of the Police, just in a different style. They're that level of uniqueness to where people would have to vulture them because they're so. I got it. This is a flat, obvious 0 for me.
Yeah, total 0. I mean, this song is unique. It does have a little bit of a country thing happening, but. Song is super unique. The band is super unique. There is no other band like Primus. You know, Primus is its own thing. Les Claypool, even if there were bands that musically sounded like Primus, no one's going to be Les Claypool on vocals and sing those words, right? So, I mean, everything about the band is unique. I mean, yeah, so I don't see any culture vulturism here at all. I would score it a 0.
I really, by the way, to kind of roll back for a second, I really love your Frank Zappa parallel with them. That was really nicely done. And I've over the years, I've tried to, I've tried to think about why Primus isn't or never was more popular than they want. I mean, they're a popular band and everybody knows who Les Claypool is. And they really, I think nowadays he's more associated with South Park than really anything else. But I feel like they're kind, and I've said this before, these guys are like Island of Misfit Toys. Try and find me an era that these guys would fit into. I can't think of one. They're so out of the box and they're so unique. I can't, they don't fit in the 80s. They really don't fit in the 90s. They don't fit in the 2000s. I'm trying to think of a time where they would actually fit in, and they don't. And that's why they're so fucking awesome, because they are that unique and talented at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they could only exist in the 90s. I mean, the 90s had so much weird music and artsy, super creative music that bubbled up in the 90s and somehow had a moment, right? And Primus had a moment. I mean, they got pretty big for, there was that Sailing the Seas of Cheese record with Jerry Was a Race Car Driver and Tommy the Cat. Did pretty well. It's pretty amazing. If you think about how weird that band is, that they had any level of commercial success could only have happened in the 90s with the whole Gen X, you know, post grunge thing. And I remember when Pork Soda came out. I mean, that was like kind of a big deal to follow up this Sailing the Seas of Cheese. And they had My Name is Mud. And then I think this record followed that one. And this was kind of their last big song before they, you know, the era ended and we're in the 2000s now. And, you know, but I mean, there was a minute. I mean, it's, but if you think about Rico, the level of just how weird this band is, that they were able to achieve any kind, they connected in a big way, in a mass way with any kind of audience, is pretty, pretty crazy, you know?
What, just off the top of your head, and if you can't think of anything, it's fine. What was the prevailing rock artists in like 93 through 95 or six, like 93 through 96, those couple of years, what was what, like what that was, like what post grunge, right? That was Cobain died in what year?
Well, he died in 94. So in 93, In Utero came out. So, and then in 94, Nirvana's MTV Unplugged came out. So
okay.
Grunge was still hot, and Nirvana was probably the biggest band in the world at that time. In 94, I think Soundgarden Super Unknown came out, which was their giant record with Black Hole Sun and Spoon
Man
and all that.
So 10 by Pearl, didn't that come out right around
that was too? A little earlier. I think that one was 90. That one I think was 91, I think.
So listen to this. 91, Sailing the Seas of Cheese, platinum. 93, Pork
That's
Soda.
Crazy.
Pork Soda, platinum. 95, Tales from the Punch Bowl, gold. And it was a top 10 in the Billboard 200. So within 4 years, they had two platinum albums, a gold album, and the gold album hit the Billboard top 200 in 4 years.
That's crazy. So I just did a quick Google thing. 1993, again, In Utero was the biggest. It's got that at number one. Wu-Tang Clan, Smashing Pumpkins, Siamese Dream, Liz Phair, Exile in Guyville, if you remember that one. Mm-hmm. So it was, and Pearl Jam was already up to the Versus album by then. So
got it.
So it was a, you know, and then Counting Crows were big that year. So
giant.
I mean, rock was still the dominant, you know, at that time, still the big thing, but. But yeah, a great year for music. Yeah. But I mean, for Primus, though, for a band is weird. And you just cited, I mean, they had big hit records for a good run of it, you know?
Yeah, for them to be that successful in that four-year run in light of all of the other artists that you just named, pretty damn impressive considering how fucking unique this band is. So why don't we tally our scores up?
All right, Rico, what do you got, man?
I've got a solid flat 1.0.
And I've got a 3 for a final score of Rico.
It would be 4.0.
The science works, right?
It always works. Like is there in the 71 of these that we've done, has there been a time when the science didn't work?
No, it's worked every single time.
No, it's flawless. It's without error. It's sincera. It's without wax. It's without flaws. So there we are. Primus is a great band. I want to know if anybody out there likes Primus, and not just casually. Okay. I want some like deep dive fans to give me some of their comments on this song and some of their famous Primus songs, because I don't think we hear from our listener or two enough, Scott. So I want to try and encourage our listeners to engage with us more, email us, tweet us, communicate with us. I mean, I'm not just talking to Scott. We're talking to you guys too. And I would like to hear from everybody out there a little bit more. I think that'd be kind of cool.
Love it. Hey, just to make the men out there who will happily use the word beaver, but get upset at the word
nice beaver
at WAP. Let's take it out. Let's end the podcast by dropping a few lines from Cardi B. Now from the top, make it drop. That's some wet ass pussy. Now get a bucket and a mop. That's some wet ass pussy. I'm talking wop, wop, wop. That's some wet ass pussy. Macaroni in a pot. That's some wet ass pussy, huh? So there you go, guys. So if you can't handle it, maybe chew this on isn't that. The podcast for you.
Chew on that one for a minute.
All right. Thank you, Rico. This has been Rock and Roll Autopsy. Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com. And if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.